You know that saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger? Well, when Nathaniel Mary Quinn was 15 years old, his family disappeared. He was a scholarship student at a boarding school, and when he went home one vacation, his family was just gone. He never found them again.
In Culver, there was something called Parents Weekend. I remember this like yesterday.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We welcome you to the Culver Military Academy Fall Parents Weekend Sunday Parade.
Parents would come to the school, and my parents obviously didn't come because they were not around. Well, they were dead. And I remember sitting there thinking, like, man, I have better grades than them. My scores are higher than theirs. I'm outperforming them. And yet, they get to relish and bask in the joy of spending time with their parents. But God took my parents away from me. How come I can't get that? I remember that. I'll never forget that. And then a part of me started to feel like, you know what? Someday they're going to know what this pain feels like. They're all going to know. They're going to know someday, someday soon.
Today, he is a blockbuster artist who's exhibited all over the world. His work is in the permanent collections of the Whitney Museum in New York, the Brooklyn Museum, the Art Institute of Chicago. And he was in town recently for a solo show of his collage-style portraits at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. And since we can't show them to you, Charles Monroe Kane asked Quinn to describe them.
You may see the torso of a man, and maybe there's an arm of a gorilla, and the legs of maybe a woman wearing, you know, stiletto shoes, and the other arm may have been borrowed from the arm of Superman, that kind of thing. So
that is a good description right there.
Yeah.
I want to quote something that you wrote. You say that we are all broken in some way. And in the midst of being broken, we find ways to embrace our brokenness and then carry on life. Is your art broken?
I wouldn't say that my art in and of itself is broken, but I do believe that my work is a reflection of humanity. And as it turns out, humanity is broken. And so I try to highlight that through my work. So I like to think that I am painting the internalized world of humanity or a particular person. So I'm painting that which is not oftentimes seen, but that which is oftentimes felt.
Which is interesting because a lot of your portraits are portraits of people you know, like your family, like your father. And if you don't mind sharing, there's a backstory with you and your father that I'm like, how do you find empathy in that, in him?
Of course, I grew up in Chicago in poverty, and my parents were illiterate. I was the youngest of four older brothers. And that means by the time I was 15 years old, the next brother may have already been 23, and then the brother from there was probably 26, and on. So I was the baby. I had this great opportunity to go to this private boarding high school called Culver Academies, and I went. I got a full-year tuition waiver, academic-based scholarship to go to this really cool school. It was academically rigorous, and you lived on this campus and in dorms. It was like paradise. Shortly after being admitted into the school, my mother passed away. A month later, I returned to Chicago with the expectation of enjoying Thanksgiving with my father and my four brothers. Upon my arrival home, I opened the door, and I was confronted with an empty apartment, no furniture. There was articles of clothing scattered across the floor. There was left in the refrigerator a 2-liter Royal Crown Cola, half a loaf of bread, and that was it. And that was the last time I actually saw my family.
Oh, Jesus. What do you think happened? You must rack your brain about that.
Well, yeah, you have to understand, my mom was the breadwinner. Now, what that means is that my mother was the only one in the family who was the recipient of state aid. So she was a welfare recipient. And, of course, my dad, he played pool. So he would work in the restaurants and make the little money he made there. And he would go to the pool hall and play pool in order to try to generate extra money.
Mm-hmm.
So when my mom died, her name was the only name on the lease. So the rest of the family could not stay in that apartment. It's just as simple as that. And my father, I mean, come on, this guy had no means by which to survive without her. Of course, years ago, I didn't understand. I was just frustrated.
Of course not. And, oh my God, it's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, clearly that this is like a pure form of abandonment and separation at its best.
What did you do?
I went to my next door neighbor. Her name was Diane Easton. And I asked Diane, do you know where my family is? They're not home. And she said in response, oh, they didn't tell you? I said, tell me what? Oh, baby, they left 2 weeks ago.
Ugh.
I said, what? And she says, yeah, they left 2 weeks ago, and I'm so sad they didn't tell you. And I knew I could not stay in that apartment because if they left 2 weeks ago, that means that apartment had already been turned into like a drug den. The local drug dealers were using that space now to conduct their drug transactions. So it wasn't safe being in those projects at night, being outside. I left, and I went to another part of Chicago, 79th Street or something like of that matter, and I found a gravestone. I just slept inside the vestibule.
I'm sorry, that's terrible.
That night, when that took place in my life, something clicked in my head. It became crystal clear what my options were, and they were very, very simple. Either I stay in this community and die young, which was a guaranteed, inevitable fact. If I stayed there, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have lived past 25. Forget about it.
Jeez.
Or I go back to this school, this boarding school. I have a full scholarship. That means that as long as I maintain a very high GPA, I can stay in this school. And this school will be my refuge and my roof. And they feed you 3-4 times a day, so I have food to eat every day. You have to wear a uniform, so I don't have to worry about buying clothes. So I have clothes on my back. So the conception of school shifted for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that compelled me to work extremely hard.
I bet.
I had created for myself a weekly study schedule. I lived and slept and breathed by that schedule. And I had rules by which I lived, one of them being to never get a GPA underneath a 3.5. Because if I get a GPA underneath a 3.5, then I'm in the red zone. That means that I run the risk of losing my scholarship. Losing my scholarship meant that I would be homeless.
Wow, geez. The pressure that you were under, grieving for your mother, your family's loss, and the abandonment of how that must have felt, like, how did you keep from just being consumed by grief?
Well, I stayed in a dorm called the band unit, and I played in the band. Every Sunday, there was a parade, and people from around the country and the world would come to Culver and watch the parade, and we would march on the field. And after every parade, when everyone headed back to have lunch at the mess hall, I stayed on the field, and I went to the golf course, and I sat on a golf mound, and I had my Walkman, and I would play Al Green's How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? And I would listen to that song, and during that time, I would mourn the loss of my family and my mother, and I would just pray, and I was just, in my own way, sit in God's grace. And then after listening to the Al Green song about 10 times, I will go back Golden Lunch. And I did this every Sunday for 4 years while I was at Culver. I had a lot of hard work ahead of me, and I was in a lot of pain. But I just worked really hard. I was very determined because I didn't want to be homeless.
Fair enough, man.
It was simple for me. I didn't want to be homeless. I didn't want to be on the street.
Did you try to find them? Did you ever go look for them?
Yeah, I did ask Diane if she knew where they had gone, and she did not know. But she did say this. She said that my father sold my mother's clothing in order to generate money to take a train to leave Chicago. I do remember that. And I went to the pool hall, because remember my dad played pool. And I asked some of the fellas in there if they had seen my father. Of course, none of them seen him. Oh, we haven't seen Rabbit Man. They call him Rabbit Man. They say, hey, we haven't seen Rabbit Man in a long time. No, we don't know. And at that point, that's when I gave up. I even went to the Cut Rate liquor store on the south side of Chicago because my brother Eugene was an alcoholic. And I went looking around the area, hoping that I would see him on the street somewhere, homeless perhaps. And I didn't see him. I didn't find him. So I then gave up on the prospects of ever finding them, and I continued on with my life, yeah.
When you paint your mom or your relatives, your father, when you make these portraits of them, are you working through your trauma, through the abandonment, while you're making them?
Yeah, I still work through the abandonment and the trauma, but also just with losing everything, losing my family, my home, my very foundation in my life, I'm still here, and I made it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
And that gives me a lot of fuel.
Have you ever considered what would have happened if on that fateful day, your father and your brothers would have been there?
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't be where I am right now. I would have ran into their open arms and accepted their embrace. You know, I would have stayed with them. I would have continued to be a part of the family fabric and probably would have never realized the sort of dreams that I've come to realize now. Hmm. And that's a good question because I believe that everything in life is designed to help you to get closer to becoming what you were meant to be. And as it turns out, growing up the way that I did has now become the sort of bedrock of all of these stories and experiences that play a pivotal part in my work. You see what I'm saying? So
yeah, totally.
It's like the universe of God placed me there for a reason. You know, come on. One's imagination is not vast enough to orchestrate such a plan. I mean, think about it. Imagine God says, okay, Quinn, listen. Your mother's about to die. So I have planned for you. I'm going to put you in this school. And it's a rich school. And you're going to be surrounded by good people because I'm about to take your family from you. But I must do this because I have a plan for you. Imagine if that was the conversation. You know, who could orchestrate such a plan? That is like a pitch-perfect blueprint.
Nathaniel, I want to thank you for some truly amazing art. I see the light in it. I understand exactly what's coming through there, good and bad, and I really appreciate it. So thank you for your story today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I can think of younger days when I lived for my life.
That's Nathaniel Mary Quinn talking with Charles Monroe Kane. Quinn was in town for a solo show at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. And if you want to see some of the images, you'll find them on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Angelo Batista. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.
Thank you. KRX.